This is Game Time AM. Now, back to Bradley and Jeff Jones from St. Louis Game Time on 590 The Fan, 105.7 HD2 FM, and InsideSTL.com.
Good morning, St. Louis. As Andy just said, you're listening to Game Time AM here on 590 The Fan, KFNS St. Louis. 590 AM, 105.7 HD2, streaming live on Inside SCL. That was Jeremy Boyer in the organ from Scott Trade Center, the organist for Blues Games, playing us back from commercial break. Glad to have that. So we have something a little bit different here. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation, and it's something that I think Blues fans should be interested in. So when the Blues came into the NHL 50 years ago in 1967, there were five other teams that came in. Six teams joined the original six, even though they weren't the exact original six, if you want to be a stickler about it, in the NHL. But it's known as the original six and then the expansion six. And one of those teams is the Golden Seals or California Seals
Oakland Seals.
Yeah, they changed names a couple times as a marketing thing. We'll get to that probably. So there's a documentary that you can get on iTunes. It's called The California Golden Seals Story. And it tells the story, the weird story, the twisted story, the twists and turns and all the different things that happened in the short-term life of the Seals based out there in California. It's an interesting watch. I watched it yesterday. There's lots of interesting interviews. Wayne Gretzky makes an appearance a couple times. And some of the stories are really quite fascinating. And so on the line this morning, we have Mark Gretschmill. He is the filmmaker behind the California Golden Seals story. He is calling in live from California, where it is 4 a.m. So there's some dedication there. Mark, good morning, sir. How are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm still having my coffee.
You know what? We are too, and it's 6 here.
Yeah, we can relate. And it's pitch black here still in St. Louis at just after 6 a.m. So thanks for joining us this morning.
I'm thrilled to be with you guys.
So tell us a little bit, how do you get behind a project that tells the story of the Golden Seals?
You mean about an obscure hockey team who played their last game 41 years ago?
Yeah.
Well, this was kind of a labor of love project for me because I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I was 9 years old when the Seals started play in 1967. And so the Oakland Coliseum was about a 10-minute drive from where I grew up, and so I went to many, many Seals games during those 9 seasons. And so, the Seals were kind of a franchise where everything that could go wrong did go wrong. You know, you had everything from white skates to orange pucks to an out-of-control owner. You had the wild uniforms. You had a tragic on-ice death. You had horrible trades. You had future superstars like Reggie Leach and Charlie Simmer. You had everything from a beautiful female streaker to people like Bing Crosby, Tom Hanks, and even the Hell's Angels. So it was a pretty fascinating story, and I thought it was a story that deserved to be told. My main job is I'm a television documentary producer, and normally I do shows like the E! True Hollywood Story, or specials like Lindsay Lohan, The Road to Jail. But I didn't want to be remembered for Lindsay Lohan, The Road to Jail. So about 2.5 years ago, I decided I want to do this. I want to tell a story of the Seals, and I did this on a micro budget. It was just me and my camera and some lighting and sound gear, and I traveled across Canada and the U.S., and I interviewed over 30 former players, team officials, journalists, fans. You mentioned Wayne Gretzky. You know, I threw a Hail Mary, and Wayne Gretzky agreed to sit down, and that, which was fantastic, and he had been a Seals fan as a kid, who knew? So I'm quite happy with how it turned out.
Now, Mark, you mentioned that you grew up 10 minutes away from the Coliseum there in Oakland. That was sort of the original challenge, right? When they founded the Seals, was whether they were going to put the team there or across the bay at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Do you think that that initial founding act had a lot to do with the way the team's history played out?
Well, there were a lot of things, you know, because a lot of people wondered why in the heck did the NHL put teams in two teams in California, you know, the Kings and the Seals. And part of that story that we tell in the documentary is that had to do with television. The NHL, with the big expansion, had signed a national TV contract with CBS, which was a big deal for the NHL. CBS said, look, you know, we want to have two teams in two of the biggest TV markets in the United States, which were Los Angeles and the San Francisco Bay Area. So that's why those cities got hockey teams. Because at the time, you know, hockey was not very big in the Bay Area. There was a team, a Western Hockey League team across the bay in San Francisco, the Western Hockey League Seals. They played at the old Cow Palace, which still stands. It's kind of a dumpy building.
It was the first home of the San Jose Sharks as well.
It was, when they were building the new arena. They had a following there, but the NHL wanted them to play in the brand new state-of-the-art Oakland Coliseum Arena across the bay. And if you're familiar with the Bay Area, San Francisco and the rest of the Bay Area are separated by bridges. And there's kind of a psychological thing. If you're in the Bay Area, going over to San Francisco is kind of a big deal. You have to drive across bridges. It's like a psychological barrier. So people, you know, they tend to not want to cross over the bridge and vice versa. So people in San Francisco, you know, didn't want to go all the way over to Oakland to see hockey games. So they had to build an entirely new fan base over there.
So we're talking to Mark Kretschmel. He's the guy behind the film on iTunes, the story of the California Golden Seals. I'll get it out eventually. It's still early. One of the interesting stories you mentioned, and the most tragic one, so there's been one on-ice death in the history of the NHL, Bill Masterson, and it happened in a game. He was a player with Montreal, I believe, and it happened in a game against the Seals. Can you talk about that kind of sad story for a little bit?
With Minnesota.
Right,
and actually, I remember as a child watching that game because that was one of the few games that you ever got to see the Seals being on television. And I remember thinking it wasn't that big of a thing. Like, it wasn't the collision didn't seem to be that out of the ordinary. What it was Bill Masterson was coming up the ice, and he tried to split two Seals players who came together, and they collided, and he fell backwards and hit his head. He had already had a head injury before, and it was one of those things. It wasn't a dirty play. Nobody involved who saw it thought it was, and I interviewed three people who were eyewitnesses to it, and then he died, I believe it was 2 days later, which really affected the way hockey with the helmets, because at that time you actually had coaches who were telling their players, you know, if you wear a helmet, you're a wuss. You know, you need to, you know, real men, don't wear helmets when they play hockey.
Insane.
Just like they used to, like goalies used to not wear face masks.
Right.
You know, it's almost inconceivable now that happened. But it was a real tragedy.
And then one of the other stories that stuck out to me. So it seemed like, you know, the Blues, I think, had a very a solid strategy where they really were going after former Cup winners. They had a really heavy presence of former Montreal Canadiens in their first couple years in the league, in the dressing room. How did the Seals try to, you know, when they had the expansion draft in their first couple seasons, you know, I watching, you know, seeing the pictures, it looked like they had a very veteran heavy roster, but did they go a little bit different direction than what the Blues tried to do?
Well, the Seals, I mean, everything was dysfunctional right from the beginning. They had a solid general manager who had been with the Western Hockey League Seals, and then with their new coach, you know, Bert Olmsted, he kind of forced out the general manager and became the GM and the coach himself. He alienated a lot of the players with his very, very strict method of coaching. And so you know, the SEALs were behind the eight. They were under pressure from the beginning because they were bleeding money. You know, people weren't coming to the games. They underestimated how the fan interest. They underestimated how to promote the team. So right from the beginning, they were talking about moving the team the first season.
That's amazing.
And then also, as they brought in for their second season, they brought in better people. They brought in people like Bill Torrey, who would later build a dynasty with the Islanders. They had Frank Selke, you know, who is a hockey legend. But to make the team better, what they started doing was they started trading away their draft choices to get good players right away. One of the more infamous trades is they traded away their draft choice for the following season to get some good players. They got a guy named Gurney Hickey, who was a solid player, and a few other people. And Montreal took that draft choice the following year and got Guy Lafleur. Ugh. So that was always something that loomed large in Seals history.
Yeah, they could have had the Flower. That's crazy. You mentioned the streaker. Can you tell the story behind the streaker on the ice at a Seals game?
Yes, well, you know, before I mention that is, you know, the Seals had a number of owners, and one of them was Charles Finley.
Right.
Finley, who owned the Oakland A's baseball team, a fellow who bragged that he had only seen one hockey game before he ever bought the Seals, who famously announced at the opening press conference when he met the media, which we have film of, is how he said, "I don't know the first thing about hockey." He had an interest in promoting the team for a couple of years and then lost interest, and he pretty much abandoned the Seals. So there was no money with the franchise. One year, the Seals' advertising budget for the entire year for everything was $5,000. The team could only afford one billboard on the freeway. You know, they had to cancel things like stick nights because they didn't have the money to get sponsors. So they had to think outside the box to promote the team. And in the early 70s, streaking was really popular. And for those who don't remember or who don't know about it, is, you know, college students were, you know, stripping and running naked across the campus or, you know, through a bar or down a street. And so the Seals PR people, they hired the girlfriend of a stick boy, the team's stick boy. And I was actually at this game. I remember this very vividly. So she came to the game. She snuck under the stands and came out at the players' bench in between periods. The Seals PR people told the photographers there, "Oh, you might want to stand over here in the corner because something might happen."
Something might happen.
So as the players came on the ice, this girl, she came out and she skated across the ice, and the place just went nuts. Not only do we have a photo of that incident, somebody sent me their old Super 8 home movies, and so we actually see her skating across the ice, and everybody looks a little flabbergasted. You know, the players are skating, also this girl goes streaking across the ice naked. They said they got more publicity from that than pretty much any of their games that year.
You're listening to 590 The Fan in St. Louis, 105.7 HD2 FM and InsideSDL.com, talking with Mark Gretschmel, the filmmaker behind the California Golden Seals story. You know, you talk about the eccentric ownership, and the very existence of Charlie Finley certainly implies eccentricity. For all the things that didn't work, the white skates and the orange pucks and even the streaker to some extent, he did make one big change that sort of stuck around in the NHL. The Seals were the first team to throw names on the back of jerseys, correct? The first team to sort of to view that as a marketing tool.
Yes, he thought that would give let the people identify with the players a lot more, and there was a lot of pushback on that because there were some cities where they thought if people knew who the players' names were, they wouldn't buy their the programs. So in places like Detroit and Toronto, the Seals actually had to travel with two sets of road uniforms, one with their names on the jerseys and one without, you know. And Finley, like he did really crazy stuff sometimes. But one of the things he did was he could be incredibly generous in some ways, you know. But in other ways, you know, he didn't want to pay the players more money. When the WHA came along, you know, he did not want to he did not want to pay the players more to stay with the NHL. He thought they would all come on their hands and knees begging to come back, and the Seals lost more players to the WHA than any other hockey team. Right on the verge when they were becoming a playoff team, they were decimated. But one thing Finley did do is he was the first owner in the NHL to fly their teams first class. You know, now of course they all have chartered planes and they travel pretty luxuriously. Back then they would just fly on commercial flights with everybody else and sit in coach. And so Finley would tell people tell his players, look, you know, you're flying cross country, you're traveling more than any other hockey team, you know, other than the Kings. You guys are flying first class. And so which the players really appreciated. One of the stories we tell in the film is, back then the Boeing 747 was a new airplane, and the players were going on a flight cross-country, and they'd never been on a 747 before. They got on the plane, and one of the guys goes upstairs to the upper deck. You know, he looks around. He decides to go into the restroom. He strips down to his underwear. He throws water all over himself, and he comes down the steps and says, "Hey guys, the pool upstairs is great. Let's go." You know, so they would have a lot of fun. On another flight, they're coming back from Boston, and they had all bought lobsters because Boston lobsters, and they decided to let the lobsters loose on the flight. So they knew how to have fun.
That'll get
all the losing.
Yeah,
that'll get an air marshal's attention these days.
We have a text here that I wanted to ask you about because this wasn't a story that that was part of the film, but it's an interesting story that I thought that you might have some memory of. There was a player for the Toronto Maple Leafs named Brian Spencer, who was drafted, called up, and was playing in his first NHL game. And apparently, his father wanted to watch the game on television, but instead the local CBC station was showing the Canucks and the Seals game. And Brian Spencer's father drove to the television station and at gunpoint forced CBC to change change over to broadcasting the Leafs game. And I mean, tragically, he was shot and killed by the RCMP that evening storming the. But had you heard that story? Were you familiar with the Brian Spencer connection?
I did not know that story. I know a lot of people weren't fans of the Seals, but
Seals Canucks game was being broadcast by CBC, and his father stormed a television station at gunpoint to turn off the Seals game.
Yeah. Not a good move.
Not at all.
That's a fascinating story. I might have put that in there if I don't about that.
That came in from a texter here who also was asking about Crazy George, who we know we saw plenty of Crazy George there in the movie with the seal bark and the big drum.
Yes, Crazy George. He was a high school teacher back in the early 70s. He went with his high school with a class to a Seals game, and he was kind of a guy, you know, he led these cheerleading things at his school, so he had brought this drum with him, and so during the game, and that was, you know, during a season where the Seals were not doing very well, and he started pounding this drum and, you know, getting his section to cheer, and he started, like, pointing his drum or his stick across the rink and getting all these different sections to stand up and sit down and yell. And so he was at the game. I interviewed him for the film. And so after the game, one of the Seals people came up to him and said, look, you know, if you ever want to come to another game, you know, we'll have a free ticket for you. So he started coming to games, and he would electrify the crowd. And I remember, I mean, you know, he started coming, and they started paying him $50 a game. So he would come up sometime during the first period, almost during a break in play, and all of a sudden, boom, 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 and the crowd would go crazy. And he would just run through the arena like a madman. He would run down to the glass on the ice. He would sneak up behind players right before a face-off and just pound the drum, and they would jump out of their skates. And so he became very, very popular with the Seals. In fact, at one point, it was the Blues, actually. The owner of the Blues wanted to hire him away from the Seals, and then rescinded the offer because he said the Seals, the Crazy George was the only thing that the Seals had going for them at that time, so he didn't want to He didn't want to interrupt them. He later took a job with Colorado. He quit his job and became a professional cheerleader. He's 70, I think 72 now, and he's still doing cheerleading.
Wow.
He was at a recent, I saw him recently when the San Jose Sharks had a Seals tribute night. But one of the things, he was at one game when Terry O'Reilly, like the tough guy for the Boston Bruins, was in the penalty box, and he was pounding the drum behind Terry O'Reilly, and Terry O'Reilly actually climbed out of the penalty box and tried to chase him up the stands in his skates. And so, you know, I interviewed George, and we have a lot of photos and a lot of actually old Super 8 film of him running through the Oakland Coliseum Arena.
That's awesome. So that's, you know, I think it's a throwback. Your film is a throwback to when the NHL was a little bit less corporate. It was a little bit
more
little less refined, I was going to say. But rowdy, I think, is a good way to put it, too. And really goes back to a time where, you know, St. Louis was also a new team in the league at the time. And some of the things that happened in St. Louis and other places around the league really endeared hockey here in St. Louis and other parts of the country that hadn't had professional hockey or NHL-level hockey before. But it still was a kind of Wild West, anything goes. Hey, let's try some wacky, weird stuff and see if it sells some tickets and gets us some attention. And I think a lot of these stories that you're telling us about the Seals really are good examples of that. So tell us where we can find the film and watch more about the Golden Seals.
Well, right now it's available only on iTunes. So if you go to iTunes or just Google it's called The California Golden Seal Story. It's 87 minutes long, and it's on the and you can either buy it on iTunes, you download it, or you can rent it through iTunes and watch it on your computer or smart TV. You know, it's been getting a lot of great attention. Got a lot of newspaper articles written about it, web articles. It's won a film festival up in Ontario, and it's going to I'm going up to actually Alberta in 2 weeks. It was selected for screening at a film festival in Alberta. So I'm really, really happy with how it turned out. You know, because it became kind of an obsession for me, this film, and you know, tracking down, you know, this old footage. I would find, you know, photos, like old news stories that hadn't been seen in 40 years. I found old audio tapes that somebody would send to me of the very last game the Seals played in Oakland before they moved to Cleveland. People sent me Instamatic photos they took at games when they were like sitting behind the bench. So I'm really, really happy with how it turned out.
Terrific. Well, thank you for joining us. I know it's early where you are. It's early here. It's even earlier where you are in California. So, Mark Gretschmel, we appreciate you being on Game Time AM this morning and telling us about the California Golden Seals story. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. That's Mark Gretschmel with the California Golden Seals story, now available on iTunes. I think it goes back to, when the Blues came in the league, you know, they didn't try as many crazy things. There are some weird things the Blues used to do. Like they all had matching cars one year. I think Barracudas. There were some different promotions that the Blues have tried over the years that, you know, maybe some other leagues and teams wouldn't have tried. I don't think the Blues would have ever tried a streaker, though, during a game. That's California.
That's a lot. Well,
California mindset, maybe.
So we talked about Crazy George, controversial figure. Because Crazy George was the inventor and the originator of the wave.
Now,
Crazy George invented the wave, and it started at hockey games.
I got to tell you, if you Google who came up with the wave, you're going to come up with a couple different inventors. Because I think there's a guy with Oregon football. I think it was Oregon. Maybe we could Google that while we're talking.
Yeah.
That also claims that he invented the wave around the same time in the 70s. Well, it was definitely a West Coast
thing. The earliest available video documentation of a wave was on October 15th, 1981, at an Oakland A's game led by Crazy George. So apparently the Seals were the lab, took it into the lab there and worked on it and perfected it.
He workshopped
it out to the A's. Right, yeah, workshopped it.
Yeah.
So the movie actually was, it was really fascinating. If you are into the history of the league, and you know, learning things about players that maybe don't get a ton of exposure. So for example, Gilles Meloche was the goaltender for the Seals and really carried that team when the team was not very good there in the '70s. And, you know, Wayne Gretzky in the film says that at the time, Meloche was the best player in the league, that he had, you know, he was carrying the team. And that's a guy who wouldn't get a lot of exposure because he played for a team that was pretty bad.
Mark mentioned one of the early coaches was the coach GM Olmstead, and he had been a former player, and there were some former teammates that were on the team playing for him at the time. And apparently he resented the fact that they were still playing and he didn't, or they had some bad blood from when he was playing with them and against them, and he would take it out on them during practice and stuff. And then the next coach, Freddie, I forget Freddie's last name.
What's the general managers? Where are the head coaches? I don't know.
The next head coach was a former AHL player, and he was a frustrated AHL player. And so he would actually play during scrimmages, during practice. And Billy Smith, the goaltender, tells the story that they realized very quickly that practice would go on until the head coach would score. And as soon as the head coach would score, he would end practice. So they'd come up with the idea that, oh, hey, I'm tired of practice. Let him score so we can end practice. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, that is crazy. You know, you say that it strikes me that this type of story about the Seals and the NHL, you know, coming in with the Blues 50 years ago would be a terrific 30 for 30 on ESPN, one of those documentaries that they do in about an hour. This seems like right up their alley, but they don't really do that many hockey movies, obviously,
right,
at ESPN, because ESPN doesn't really pay attention to hockey.
Correct.
So Mark kind of took it on himself to tell the story and really fill in the gap for some kind of important NHL history for 50 years ago.
Yeah, one of the most amusing and also unbelievable parts of this story was about a general manager named Gary Young, who was general manager a couple of times there. And Gary Young lost his job the first time because he was agreeing to contracts with players at one salary, but then telling Charlie Finley the salary is for a different number.
Oh, my God.
And so players were getting paid a fraction of what they thought their negotiated salary was, and this is why we have a Players Association. By the way, if you look at the all-time leading scorers for the California Golden Seals, two of them, Dennis Marouk and Joey Johnson, are interviewed in the picture. The fourth all-time leading scorer is an infamous figure in Blues history, Ted Hampson, who was the director of amateur scouting for the Blues. And I see you roll your eyes at the mention of Ted Hampson.
Ted Hampson could arguably be the worst scout in NHL history. The draft picks that were wasted. And actually, he was still in charge when they were throwing first round draft picks around like they were quarters, when they were trying to sign Scott Stevens and Brendan Shanahan and all those times where they just really threw away first round picks. You know, what were they going to do with them? Ted Hampson was making the pick. So that's how
fourth leading scorer in the history of the California Golden Seals.
Wow. All right. We're going to be switching gears here in a second here on Game Time AM here on 590 The Fan, KFNS St. Louis. We have a caller before we get to our next guest. Let's go to the phone line here real quick. I believe we have Hockey Bob on the phone. Hockey Bob, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I just have a quick question for you guys. You know, I listen to a lot of sports talk radio and read a lot of stuff, and I get the impression from fans around the NHL that they don't want their star players being checked at all. And I'm not talking illegal checks where it can hurt them. I'm talking about checks that are part of the game. And if that's true, I have a real problem with that, because this is hockey, and checking is part of the game. If your star players can't take a little physical checking, then they probably shouldn't be in the game any more than me or you should be in the game. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
I think hitting is part of the game. The H in hockey stands for hitting, right? Right, Jeff?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm not sure how we got on that topic.
Because I always just hear people complaining anytime a star player gets hit, and it's like, really, it's part of hockey. You know, just because you're a star player doesn't exempt you from taking a legal hit. Now, illegal hits are different. I don't want anybody getting illegal hits, getting injured. But, you know, I hear this from fans. I read it on pages. I read it on blogs. And I just get tired of hearing it because, like you said, like I say, checking is part of hockey. And if the star players can't deal with it, then they probably shouldn't be in the league. But that's my thoughts for the morning, guys. Thank you very much.
All right, that's Hockey Bob. That's the Hockey Bob moment of the day here on Game Time AM, I guess.
You know,
we should get a sponsor for Hockey Bob.
No, we shouldn't. I believe that there are certain kinds of traumatic brain injury that express themselves as uncontrollable verbal outbursts. Honest to God, I thought that Hockey Bob would have a thing to say about the Golden Seals because that seems like a guy who would remember the Seals and care.
But we're talking about him. I should have known better. It's okay. No worries. So we're gonna change gears again here. We're versatile here in Game Time AM. We can go from the Golden Seals to talking about hitting in hockey to talking about hockey mascots. We go from Hockey Bob to someone who wants to be known as Louis the Third. Louis the Third, are you there on the phone line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
This is going to be an interesting conversation because since the inception, since the birth of Louis, dropping through the scoreboard, dressed as a Blues Brother character, who is actually a Chicago movie, which I think is kind of mixing your metaphors maybe, I think it's been a hot topic among hardcore Blues fans. You know, I understand the idea behind a mascot, that you're trying to reach out to kids, you're trying to reach out to maybe non-traditional hockey fans or making new hockey fans. So I'm kind of curious, Mr. Louis III, how did you get the job of being the guy in the big, it is a bear suit, it's not a rat suit. Let's first make that clear. It is a bear suit.
Yeah,
right?
It is a bear suit, yeah.
Some people call him a pantsless rat, though. Yeah. How did you get that job?
Some people do. So I was actually doing some backup mascot work in Columbus for the Blue Jackets. And so that's a whole other story. The ill-fated Boomer was definitely something that is also on my resume.
That's a bug, right?
Yeah, that's the
Boomer was the cannon, wasn't he? Boomer the anthropomorphic like phallic cannon?
Yes, it was.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Wow, we've got a celebrity on our hands.
So I was doing some backup work up there, and then there was a job posting, and I was going through some stuff in Columbus that, you know, I could have kept or left. And so applied, came down, auditioned, and got that job, got the Louis the Third, as we say, gig. And the rest is kind of history. It was an emergency need for the Blues. I think their guy had just left for another more kind of prestigious mascot gig, and I kind of came in, filled the spot, and was there for the.
We got so many questions. So you moved to St. Louis to become Louis. That's fascinating to me, and that the guy you replaced moved on to a quote unquote more prestigious mascot.
What's a more prestigious mascot job? Like, what's the next level?
Let's put it this way. There's kind of tiers. Like, everybody knows Fred Bird and all MLB mascots. And I would say, but if you're a really great performer, where you want to be is in the NBA. And so I think that's where he ended up. So
wow.
That's interesting.
That's awesome.
So the NBA is the top tier of mascotdom. So
yeah,
I actually
let you get away with a lot more.
So I have to ask, and this is going to be the most serious question, I think, probably of the entire interview. You said you spent time as the backup in Columbus. Now, we talked a lot about the arena improvements in St. Louis and the general sort of game day experience. Columbus is a place that I've been to see a game, and I was really impressed by the facilities there and the area surrounding it. How do you compare the facilities and the kind of in-game experience in Columbus with what we had in St. Louis?
I will say I loved being up in Columbus. It was great. The people there were really great, and like you said, it's almost a surprisingly good experience up there game day. When I got here, it was a little bit of a letdown. It was a little bit, the facility was, you know, from Kiel, being known as Kiel Center to Scott Trade Center, and then now whatever it gets renamed to next. I mean, it was a little bit of a letdown, but
I'm glad I'm not the only one this season.
Yeah. We've had some disgruntled Twitter followers getting after us, being critical of the building. I think it's kind of becoming a touchy subject here. So we're talking to Louis III, the third, we believe, Louis, person to play Louis. So is that considered a somewhat full-time job? I mean, I know that obviously you have a lot to do with the game presentation and the antics of Louis during games, before games, after games, all that stuff. But there's also lots of other appearances for Louis, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was a full-time job. There's a little bit of an intricacy to that part of the mascot business. There's some places that are where it's just full-time performance. Like you said, all you're doing is appearances and games. And then there's jobs like the Blues where it was when there wasn't an appearance or game, I was in the office coordinating the Blues, the kids club and things like that. Really kind of coordinating, being my own coordinator at the same time as being. So games and everything were factored into the hours, but it was a full-time job.
So in the process of coordinating those appearances and doing the sort of business end, when you spoke to people about appearances, did they know that they had the Louis on the line, or did you have like a, you know, superhero secret identity where you were, you know, you were to them a sort of anonymous person in the business office, but they didn't know that you would also be showing up in the suit?
No, I talked about myself in the third person constantly. we talked, you know, you'd get these phone calls and everything that mentions, do you want to schedule an appearance? You know, contact Andrew, the mascot coordinator or something like that. And that'll just happen. And there's a little bit of a, you know, the fewer people who know who you are when you're doing that job, the better, because you don't whip your head around when somebody calls out your real name.
Right.
And you just respond to the character name. So it was a little bit, for me, it was a very Clark Kent Superman kind of thing.
That's you awesome. Are listening to Game Time AM on 590 The Fan in St. Louis. We have Louis the third Louis for the St. Louis Blues on the line right now. There's a text here from the 636. And this might be a little bit of a trade secret, so I don't know if you can confirm or deny. This text claims there are two Louis at a given game, that it's not one person. Is that, can you confirm or deny that may be the case?
I will say when I was Louis, there was just me.
Okay.
But it could be changed now.
It could be changed now.
Is there like
it could have changed, I mean.
Is there like a secret handshake or anything about like this Louis secret society? Like, you ever guys get together and have a beer or anything and hang out, trade stories about being in the suit?
I wouldn't say that in St. Louis there is, but I know other historical mascot programs, some kind of the more sporting ones, there is almost a secret society. I will say it's really cool when you go to the All-Star games and have all the mascots together in any league and in any, at any level, NCAA or pro, getting everybody together and sharing stories, picking each other's brains on what's worked for you funny-wise and what hasn't, and the jokes that fall flat that nobody should ever do again.
All right, so let's get down to some nitty-gritty. So I've got some really tough questions here. Did you ever feel uncomfortable not wearing pants as a giant blue bear?
Honestly, it was the easiest thing because people would call you out on it all the time, and you can react to it every single time. It never gets old. So I would say I have a pretty good memory, and so sometimes I would go to the same places in the stands, and I'd know somebody was going to call me out on it, and so I'd, you know, wrap a towel around my waist and things like that and play up the shtick, but I would say it never got on my nerves.
That's awesome. How does putting the head on, does it smell funny?
If you don't take care of it, yes.
So is there like a case of Febreze in the office where you have to Febreze Louis' head like every day?
I actually, after working at a chemicals company, I had a special mixture that I made. And you know, there's different guys swear by different things, but the thing that worked for me is just making sure that the head was washed and making sure inside was sprayed down with something like 50-50 mix of alcohol and water, rubbing alcohol, let's specify.
Right.
Rubbing alcohol and water and letting it dry out completely. And then when you did have those not so fresh moments, you did hit it with a thing of Febreze. I know some guys swear by Axe body spray, but I don't feel like
that would be rough.
I never felt like smelling like the middle school hallway after it or before a dance. So it wasn't my gig.
I couldn't imagine putting yourself in a cloud, your head in a cloud of Axe body spray inside a enclosed space like a mascot head. Holy cow!
Yeah,
all right, I got one more ultra serious behind the curtain question. So I have a very vivid memory of being at a Cardinals game in the early 90s. It was a twi-night doubleheader. So the first game started at 6 o'clock at night. It went into extra innings. The second game didn't start till 10:30. and Fred Bird was still in the stands at about midnight, 12:30, and he was being accosted, almost like pursued in through the stands by a couple of drunk guys. They were trying to give him a hard time. And Fred Bird actually sought refuge with some fans that were sitting behind us. And all of a sudden, he just started talking to us and telling us this story about these drunk guys chasing him around the stadium. And it was jarring to me to hear Fred Bird talking like in a normal voice, like it was no big deal that Fred Bird was talking. How strict are the rules on talking as Louis? And did you ever do that? What was your standard for if you could ever kind of drop the curtain and kind of speak in your own voice as Louis?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's two schools of thought. There's the people who are purists about it, and, you know, it's all about the character. Keep the curtain up all the time. And only in extreme emergencies do you talk to somebody who is there to help you. You know, they call them mascot handlers or mascot assistants and stuff like that. I fall into that category, but I know there's tons of other guys who just will sit there and talk, and as long as there's not a kid around, we'll just, you know, talk. And it, like you said, it is jarring. I mean, it's totally drops. I mean, it's like watching a movie when the whole topic of suspension of disbelief, you're supposed to just put everything else out of your mind and do that and watch the movie and be engaged. And if that happens, it's incredibly difficult to be able to be a part of the whole mystique. So other guys do it. I'm not one of them. So,
so I have to ask, I had a friend when I was in college who worked at Chuck E. Cheese. And let's just say that occasionally the Chuck suit would make an appearance at social occasions. There may have been some pictures taken with the Chuck E. Cheese suit in some compromising positions.
Scandal.
Do you have anywhere in your private collection any artwork portraying Louis in a less than flattering light? And if so, is there a good one you can make reference to here on the radio?
Unfortunately, I do not have for the sake of the story, I do not have it anything like that. Like I said, I moved here for this job, and it was not something I was
probably not worth taking the Louis head home to like do beer bongs through it, I guess, right? If it's
no, full time
job,
it,
right?
It did make its way home for some washing and for some maintenance, but never for anything.
Never any shenanigans.
Impugn the honor,
right,
of the suit. So.
Do you have a crazy story, either an event that went crazy wrong or awkward, or
did anybody ever like book Louis for a bachelorette party? Like,
I did do a funeral once.
You did a what? A funeral?
It wasn't like an open viewing or an open casket or anything. It was more of just a memorial luncheon, I think it was. I walked in there. It was at the Missouri Athletic Club, and you walk in there and you have this pasted on grin because it's a mascot suit that you can't change the facial features on. It's not Disney. It's not the Coca-Cola bear from, you know, Atlanta, if anybody's been there. But you walk in and you have this 1,000-yard stare and this smile, and you're walking around with people who are mourning a friend and loved one, and you're just shaking people's hands, like, you know, putting your hand over your heart, like, oh, I'm sorry, trying to emote, I'm sorry. Like, in that moment, you wish you could talk and just say, don't pay no attention to the face. I know you're feeling terrible. I think it was like 35 minutes or 40 minutes of just walking around the people dressed in black, holding, you know, sandwiches that you get at one of those memorial service luncheons, and being them feeling so out of place and so awkward.
I mean, did you at least get to put the black suit like on over the Louis costume, right? Because I know Louis has the black Blues Brothers suit. You could have worn that in, I guess, right?
Yeah, it was a consideration, but I actually got direction to not do that. I said they were like, he was a huge Blues fan, just wear the jersey, it'll be great. And it was so. There was such cognitive dissonance on that.
Yeah,
I still to this day will never forget walking in and everybody being like, a hushed, oh, is Louis here instead of Louie? You know,
was there anyone who was like really offended, like a loved one of the deceased who got really angry? Like that is a bizarre and a jarring image for a funeral luncheon.
Absolutely, I'd have no idea if they did feel that way.
No one accosted you.
They never called. Yeah, they never called me back and said, "Oh, that was inappropriate. Who did this?" And you know,
well, that's
there wasn't a what is this moment. So, and then the other quick story I'll say about something that went wrong. It was at a Minnesota Wild game. I was messing with one of the fans in the stands from the Minnesota Wild. Took his hat, you know, ran away with it, threw it down the concourse stairs, and everybody got a big laugh out of it. He thought it was funny, but he followed me to the elevators and came back and said, "Hey, Louie, next time you throw my hat, why don't you expletive delete it, get it," and shoved me into the elevators. And I mean, it was, security was on him so quickly. And that was probably the most, you know, the most dangerous fan altercation, I guess I could say, I ever had.
Wow. You don't put your hands on the bear. I guess that's the number one rule.
I have to ask, is there protective equipment underneath the Louis suit? Is there like, do you have to wear a cup?
This way, you don't want to put anything on there that could inhibit the sweat you were trying to pour out.
Okay.
Wow.
I mean, let's put it this way. It's like going to the gym, you know?
And that's why you have to have that special mixture of stuff to clean the inside and have the Febreze ready.
Right. It was
on those warm days.
Let's put it this way. Also, I was in far better shape when back in 11 and 12 and 13 when I was doing this. So
it's probably good cardio to put on the mascot suit and run up and down the stairs at Scott Tree 40 nights a year.
Yeah.
It was. Oh yeah. And there were some times where you'd run down the stairs and your legs would just give out, and the comical slam into the boards or into the glass was more real than it probably was normally.
He's a method actor. That's you know,
yeah, you gotta
real,
sell it.
Realism to it. Yeah.
There's a text here that was asking. So there's two texts that I kind of want to combine here. One was asking what the most financially lucrative mascotting job was, and another was asking for the Mount Rushmore of mascots and mentioned Benny the Bull. So if the NBA is the pinnacle of mascot careers, Benny the Bull to me is the most visible of the NBA mascots. Is there or the Suns gorilla? I guess I don't know.
What about the Philly Fanatic?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I mean, what is the pinnacle? Like, what is the dream job for a mascot performer?
I think it depends on whether you're an athletic dunking type mascot or if you're a cuddly character mascot. I actually was having this conversation with some coworkers the other day, and we were talking about how the Phoenix Suns gorilla and guys like that are dunkers, and Benny the Bull, you know, small costumes that let you move a lot or move around a lot. And then there's guys like Clutch the Bear, who hit the guy who initiated that character. Just retired after 26 years.
Clutch the Bear is where?
Clutch the Bear is in Houston Rockets.
Gotcha.
So, but then there's, on the other side, as far as well-known to that question, so those are pretty lucrative positions, and the longer that you can build, the more money you can, it's just like everything else, the more money you bring in, the more money you can negotiate to what, you know, what comes to you and what stays with the club. But then you go to, as far as most well-known, the guy who started it all was San Diego Chicken back in...
We just had a chicken shout-out on the text line, yeah.
Yeah, so exactly. So you've got the San Diego Chicken, who was the kind of the first one to really do mascoting, like, you know, as we know it today. And then from that, you know, the next probably most popular would probably be the Philly Fanatic, and most well-known for the Phillies. He's somebody who's, you know, in the industry, the guy who started that character is, you know, he started the Mascot Hall of Fame that's going up in Whiting, Indiana. There's actually an actual brick building that's going to go up, and it's going to be like a museum and Hall of Fame kind of thing.
I had no idea.
So as far as, yeah, they've been working really hard for a lot of years to try and get people to know about it. It's a very niche market.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
Yeah, but so I'd say, as far as well-known, like the Mount Rushmore, like the text said, let's go San Diego Chicken as the kind of the forefather, the Philly fanatic, as you know, the next great, like the next great one, and then probably, you know, regionally, like you said, Benny the Bull, just as well known as Michael Jordan for sure, and just as comedic, I'd put him up there. And maybe he's Roosevelt, you know, with the head turned a different direction. But and let's pick a fourth one.
Well, I can tell you,
Michael Clark.
Yeah, the four that were on Stubby Applause's Mount Rushmore were the Philly Fanatic, Benny the Bull, Fred Bird, which I guess is the Homer pick, and he said the WKU Hilltopper, but we know here in the industry that's Big Red.
Big Red is
the mascot.
Yeah. Big Red, yes.
As far as college
goes. As far as college goes, yeah, that's a good pick.
See, a Big Red Grimace.
That's the 5-12 upset you hope never happens. So.
Awesome. Well, hey, Louis III, we appreciate you calling. I learned a lot on this
conversation.
This has been one of
my favorite interviews of all time, I think, actually.
In the 4-week history of Game Time AM, you're on the Mount Rushmore.
You are, in fact. This is on the Mount Rushmore for sure.
Until I get bumped off the edge, we'll be good. So,
man, I'll tell you what. We have a 314 texter who loves mascots because he's firing off additions to that Mount Rushmore. He's got the Suns Gorilla and also Mr. Met. Mr. Met's a good call.
Mr. Met.
Mr. Met is a good call. Yeah. I'll put real quick anecdote. I was on a Mascot Hall of Fame tour back in, I don't know when, just trying to drum up some interest for it when I was in college. And Mr. Met was one of the guys that was on a press junket with us. We met Kevin Bacon, so now everybody listening is now only 2 degrees from Kevin Bacon. Mr. Met.
That sentence, I was on a press junket with Mr. Met and Kevin Bacon was there.
And so we were running around, and long story short, Mr. Met cut somebody off running and got a big old friendly New York F you, Mr. Met. And so that became the refrain for the entire weekend.
Awesome.
Just laying into Mr. Met, everything he did.
Pretty awesome. Wonderful.
All right. Hey, Louis III, we really appreciate it. We'll have to maybe have you on again sometime and talk some other stories because this has been awesome. So thanks for giving us the inside scoop on being Louis and some of your other mascot stories. We appreciate it this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, no problem, guys. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thank you. All right, so we're here really close to the end of the show. Do we have time for 3 stars of the show?
I want to burn through a couple things in the text line real quick. His text line was blowing up during the Louis III interview.
Awesome.
One real quick before it started, Dave with a cauliflower ear texts in to ask if they can sponsor to not hear Hockey Bob anymore. Yes, if you want to pay us to not put him on the air, we will happily take your money, Dave with a cauliflower ear. A couple others, the sausage wheelie wants to know where the guy from the Utah Jazz falls in the standings. Fan of Frank wanted to know if he knows Yuppie. I'm a big Yuppie guy.
Oh, Montreal. Used to be with the Expos.
Yeah. So there's a lot of interest for sure.
I think
Louis
we'll have to have Louis III back on, and maybe he can pull some connections we could get. The current Louis.
Yeah.
We'll have to see what we can.
If we're gonna do 3 stars very briefly, the number 3 star, we're gonna go with Wikipedia today. Did a lot of hopping around Wikipedia to learn things about the Golden Seals and then
Mark Gretschmel with the California Golden Seals.
Well, I think he has to be the number 1 star, right?
Well, okay, sure. The filmmaker,
he cuts a check, so he's number 1.
And Louis III is our 2nd star.
For sure,
right, that's fair enough. All right, we're actually kind of running behind here, so the TMA guys are chomping at the bit to get in the studio to get the Morning After started. So. We just have to tell you goodbye. So this has been Game Time AM. Check us out on InsideSCL.com for audio stuff, or if you want to, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Store, any of your podcast apps. We would appreciate it. We'll be back tomorrow with more hockey talk on Game Time AM. Good morning, St. Louis.